actually, the air raid just went off right now, but it's quiet. Yesterday, the Orthodox Church celebrated Palm Sunday, which is the beginning of Holy Week, and the air raid siren went off then, and that still didn't stop people from waiting outside the church to get their palms blessed. I spoke to a couple there, Savage Alexi and Sincheco Valentina, outside the church. Let's listen. Does this mean something different this year, this Easter season?
Вона взагалі не відчувається.
Pretty much you can't feel it at all. Right?
Я в це вірю. Я навіть скажу таку якусь.
I'm a strong believer. And obviously, when I go to church, I put some candles for our military and for our guys to protect them.
Постійно, коли виходжу в церкву, ставлю одну за упокій Путіна.
And I don't know how reasonable it is to do it. Maybe it's a bit strange thing. But I also do one candle always for death of Putin.
A candle for the death of Putin. So yeah, look, you can see spring flowers here and people are planning gatherings for Orthodox Easter next week. But there's always this sense of unease, of fear that death and destruction of this war could catch up with you at any moment.
NPR's Ada Peralta in Dnipro, Ukraine. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
For COVID-19, federal officials seem to have adopted a refrain.
We have the tools. We have the tools and protocols.
We have the tools we need to protect.
We have the tools.
3 years ago, before COVID-19 even began, officials in the Trump administration said the same thing about the HIV epidemic.
We have the tools. This is an historic opportunity.
That is the former Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar speaking with NPR in 2019. But those who've worked on HIV for decades say to stop a pandemic, it's not enough to have the tools. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports.
Stephanie Brooks Wiggins is 76 years old. She lives in Baltimore. She was diagnosed with HIV in 1986. Back then, there were no tools to help her.
There was no treatment. There were no drugs. You'd go to the clinic and the psychiatrist would talk to you to keep you from going off the deep end.
Over the decades, scientists developed many HIV treatments, and they got better and easier to take, she says. But HIV has not ended in the U.S. as these tools became available. A stubbornly high number, more than 30,000 people, are diagnosed with HIV every year. Only 25% of people who might be eligible actually take a preventive pill called PrEP. And even with accurate and at-home options for testing, over 150,000 people in the U.S. are HIV positive but don't know it.
Scientific discoveries are a necessary but not sufficient factor to completely eradicate disease.
That's Dr. Adora Adamora, a physician and professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She first started treating people with HIV in the 1980s. She says the tools to combat HIV have come a long way. There are now topical gels and easy-to-take pills and even injections.
I don't know that I ever greeted any of these new advances saying this is the thing that's going to end HIV.
That's because she's seen the barriers to access and implementation, she says. Barriers like the high cost of prescription drugs and the maddening patchwork healthcare system. The barriers to COVID's tools, like tests and vaccines and therapeutics, have been different. But A. Tony Young says there are parallels and common mistakes. She lives in West Virginia and runs the Community Education Group, which does public health outreach.
We keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, saying, it's over there, why don't you go get it?
That attitude hasn't worked to fight HIV or COVID, Young says. It doesn't work for people who don't have access to healthcare, who don't trust the medical system, or who don't think they're at risk. As she sees it, when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, the country has missed out on the chance to make the most of the vaccine by failing to understand and work with people in all their complexity.
It was an all-or-nothing approach. You're either with me on this vaccine or you're not. You're either on my side or you're my enemy when it comes to the vaccine. You're either a vaccine denier or you're a vaccine getter. And there's a whole lot of room between those two.
The frame of us versus them is implicit in a lot of the rhetoric these days about getting back to normal. It's in terms like pandemic of the unvaccinated and telling people they've done the right thing by getting vaccinated and should therefore have special privileges, like not being punished with things like indoor masking and testing requirements. That way of talking about public health, says Stephen Thrasher, creates the conditions for pandemics to last longer. Thrasher is a professor of journalism at Northwestern and author of the forthcoming book, The Viral Underclass. With HIV in the mid-1990s, when treatments became much more effective,
people who got access to the drugs began to pull away and take their political capital and go home because they didn't need to be in the fight anymore. And the virus continued to pool in what I call a viral underclass in the United States.
This was a sad and lethal mistake in the fight against HIV, he says, and now it's happening again. The lack of political will in Congress to pass more COVID-19 funding is a perfect example, he says. And those still at particular risk are those who are warehoused away, out of sight.
People who are in nursing homes as elderly people or who are in convalescent centers as disabled people, and of course, people who are incarcerated, they're already out of public view and people are not listening to them.
Those settings can act as epidemic engines, he explains. People visit their loved ones in these places, staff come and go back into the community, and so the pandemic drags on and lives are needlessly lost. He is disappointed that policymakers seem to be centering the people who have the most access to tools to protect themselves, not the least.
I really hoped that that would be different this time.
This is not to say no one is trying to get the available tools out to people who don't have as much power and access. A. Tony Young in West Virginia has one idea for how to do it.
We want to hit people in the face with the COVID vaccination because we're in the middle of the pandemic. But maybe I got to slow walk you to that COVID vaccination.
Here's how that might go.
If you got 5 kids and y'all are hungry, you need to figure out where you're going to get food from. You don't care about my vaccine. Let me help you. What do you need from me? If I can get you the food that you need, when we do the follow-up, hey, did the food voucher work out for you? Great. Can we talk to you now about the COVID vaccine?
Her organization has a $3.5 million cooperative agreement with CDC to use this approach to vaccinate people against COVID-19 and influenza in West Virginia. Young hopes CDC will continue funding this for 3 years so they can expand. She also hopes to spread one of the lessons from HIV, that people and their relationship to health is complicated, and the public health response needs to be ready to meet them where they are. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
Later on All Things Considered, since the pandemic began, many places have seen soaring numbers of people becoming unhoused. In the sprawling Brazilian city of Sao Paulo, one man is fighting for their rights and winning friends and enemies in the process. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from the Alzheimer's Association, dedicated to the advancement of Alzheimer's research. At any given moment, research, discovery, and learning are happening. Learn more at alz.org. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive Nerve Relief. Nervive is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet. Learn more at nervivehealth.com.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19 now, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in 15 minutes, Leila Fadel speaks to International Crisis Group analyst Mayrav Zonzain about unrest in Jerusalem and what it means for the already volatile region.
Stablecoins are considered the bedrock of the crypto world. But
if you were to see a problem with stablecoins, we actually don't know because this is essentially an unregulated market.
I'm Rima Khreis, an explainer on stablecoins, next time on Marketplace.
Hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/WPR.
Support comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside, in partnership with UW Extended Campus. Details at uwp.edu.
In the weather forecast, rain and snow likely around the state today, breezy in the north and a high around 40. On Tuesday, a mix of sun and clouds in the southeast, mostly sunny for the rest of Wisconsin, highs mostly in the mid to upper 40s, but cooler near Lake Superior.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University at Buffalo, an AAU public research university, where aerospace engineers are working to identify and track space debris to clear the way for new moon missions. buffalo.edu/NPR. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And from Fidelity Wealth Management, working to help create a comprehensive plan for a client's full financial picture. More at Fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have an alternative view this morning of a drive by Texas to slow down border crossings. Governor Greg Abbott acted earlier this month.
With the Biden administration ending Title 42 expulsions in May, Texas will be taking its own unprecedented actions this month.
Title 42, President Biden is lifting COVID limitations that reduced the number of people entering the United States from Mexico. Governor Abbott did not approve, so he took a variety of steps. He called for state authorities to conduct enhanced safety inspections of commercial trucks from Mexico. That has led to massive delays for commercial trucks. And a member of his own party is not pleased. Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller called the new inspection policy catastrophic. Here's his understanding of the state policies.
One is to haul the illegal aliens to Washington, D.C. and dump them out there. He's had three trips. I think he's a total of about 75. You know, about 25 to 30 in each busload. They have to volunteer to go. In other words, anybody that was planning on going to Washington, D.C., we give them a free ride up there now. The other one's one I had more problems with, and he decided to stop every commercial truck that's coming into Texas from Mexico and give them a safety inspection. This caused a lot of economic hardship, backlog, clogged up all of our ports, completely shut them down for a while. For the most part, it set us back, and we've had disruptions. We've got rotting produce and fruit on trucks that can't, you know, get across in a timely manner. We've got American trucks in Mexico that can't get out. So I've already seen the price of avocados double, and lemons and limes have doubled in this just this 1 week period.
Was there any evidence beforehand that people were using produce trucks to sneak into the United States?
My people and the USDA people, we inspect every truck. We go through all the contents. CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, the manufactured goods, the non-produce trucks, they send all them through x-rays. They have drug-sniffing dogs. They have people that check the trucks for hollow compartments. We've been through all those. We just checked them. And the governor's people have no authority to open the trucks. All they can do is check for faulty turn signals, brake lights, you know, brake linings, tire tread, that kind of stuff. Just safety issues.
I don't quite understand what you're telling me, Commissioner. I think you're telling me that the trucks are already inspected, but they're delayed now at the border so that the state can inspect them again in this superficial way. Is that right?
You got it. But they don't inspect the trucks. They just do a safety inspection. They don't inspect the contents.
You told me about trucks stuck at the border. What is the scene then at some of the ports of entry from Mexico into Texas?
Well, Laredo is our biggest inland port. One day's time, normal day, we'll have from 15,000 to 20,000 trailer trucks back and forth through that port. They're averaging about 500 a day through Laredo. So we've got 20,000 trucks or more backed up waiting to get through. Some of these truckers, you know, there's no restroom. They're running out of diesel. The only other option they have for the produce is to drive to Nogales, Arizona, which is 1,250 miles. It's open. You can go through there. Then you have to drive another 1,250 back to Dallas, Houston, or San Antonio to the distribution warehouses. So that's a 2,500-mile detour.
Isn't this something that is going to affect food prices way beyond Texas?
Yes, it already has. You've already seen things like bananas, avocados, lemons, and limes, you know, winter vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, you know, leafy greens. Those prices are all right. They were already rising. But the biggest deal is we have a crisis on the border, but we also have a shipping and delivery crisis. And this is compounding that. So you can't fix one crisis by creating another one. The governor is kind of backtracking now. He's cut a deal with three of the four governors. We have, let's see, four of the 29 bridges open now. He's did a memorandum of understanding that the governors of those three Mexican states won't let any unsafe trucks come through. And that's it.
Did the governor call you before he announced this policy?
Well, you know, he says I'm uninformed, and I guess I am, because I haven't heard from him. He hadn't told me. He hadn't explained anything. I sent him a letter laying out what I just laid out to you, that we're going to see higher food prices. If it goes on long enough, we'll have, for the third time in his administration, empty grocery store shelves in the produce aisle.
Could he argue that this is just hardball politics? He wanted to have some leverage to hold over the Mexican state governors, and now he's getting something for it.
You know, I think there's some truth into that. I certainly wouldn't have taken that approach. I'd have used a kinder, gentler approach and see if I couldn't have negotiated a deal. You know, this is our best trading partner, and we don't need to be making them mad and creating friction and hard feelings. We need to, you know, work with our brothers and sisters to the south and see if we can't work in an equitable, agreeable, non-threatening way to solve this problem.
This, in a way, is a prelude. You talked about the importance of your partners to the south. There's going to be increasing tension, it would seem, with your partners to the south because Title 42 is going to be lifted. COVID restrictions are being lifted for people to enter the United States. There's a giant backlog of people waiting to enter the United States, and we're expecting to see a great number of people in late May. And I can imagine now, and you can imagine also, the headlines, the political statements that will be made, the concerns that will be raised. What's the best way to get through that?
Well, these two moves by our governor do nothing to stop the flow of illegal immigration or illegal drugs. I mean, absolutely zero. It's a very easy fix, actually. If you want to fix the immigration problem and head off the Title 42 surge, you just reinstate the Trump-era policies. I'm not talking about just building the wall, but stopping the surge before it gets to American soil, stop it on the southern border of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras. We had agreement worked out down there where those surges weren't coming through, and that slowed the influx of illegal immigration into Texas, you know, immensely.
Isn't it an election year in Texas?
It is. I'm up for re-election, and, I want the governor to be re-elected. I'm not, you know, looking to Beto O'Rourke to be my governor. I hope the governor's successful. You know, I would like to, you know, hopefully he would take some advice. I think this is really hurting him in South Texas.
Commissioner Miller, thanks so much. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Anytime. Thank you, sir.
This is NPR News.
What is the emotional toll of fleeing your home in wartime?
Every day of war makes you harder, less emotional. Then I see some destroyed village and cry some in some silent corner.
I'm Elsa Chang. One Ukrainian family tries to forge a new life. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In news, a policy at the Waukesha School District that bans political and controversial signs is getting pushback from students and the American Civil Liberties Union. Details in our newscast in just a minute.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Russian forces have carried out a series of missile strikes in western Ukraine today that killed 7 people and wounded 11 others, including one child. NPR's Ada Peralta reports many Ukrainians have sought refuge in Lviv amid the ongoing invasion.
It's home to a lot of Ukrainians who have fled for more dangerous parts of the country. But today, local authorities say several Russian missiles struck the city. They say that civilians were killed and that one of the missiles hit a tire repair shop, but most were aimed at infrastructure. These are the first fatalities that have been recorded in the city of Lviv.
NPR's Ada Peralta reporting. The United Nations says it's deeply concerned by reports of civilians killed in airstrikes in Afghanistan. NPR's Dia Hadid reports it appears that Pakistan's Air Force carried out the attack.
Around 40 people were killed, including women and children. Since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, there's been an increase in what appears to be cross-border attacks by a breakaway Taliban offshoot. Pakistani officials say they've repeatedly requested Afghanistan's rulers secure the border area. The Taliban insists Pakistan should negotiate directly with the militant group.
That's NPR's Dia Hadid reporting from Islamabad. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 22 points. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A policy at the Waukesha School District that bans political and controversial signs is getting pushback from students and the American Civil Liberties Union. They say it's been unevenly applied. Students and teachers say that flyers for the Gay-Straight Alliance and Black Student Union were removed, along with pride and pro-police flags and posters with the district's own non-discrimination policy. Chris Donahoe is an attorney at the ACLU of Wisconsin. She submitted a public records request for information on how the ban on controversial signs is being implemented. She says it likely violates students' and teachers' First Amendment rights to free speech.
This is the essential problem with the Waukesha policy. It's overly broad and vague. And that means that the administrators can pick and choose what they determine to be vague or controversial or somehow not in the curriculum.
The school district says it's trying to create a neutral environment for teaching and learning by removing things that could be disruptive. The Madison School District will keep its current indoor mask mandate for students, staff, and visitors while inside school buildings in place until May, according to the State Journal. The district made the announcement Friday. Officials plan to reevaluate and provide an update on May 6th. Madison is one of the last remaining districts in Dane County to still have a mask mandate in place after others relaxed their policies. The district says masks continue to be an effective way to prevent the spread of COVID-19, especially as cases start to tick up in Dane County. Over the last 4 weeks, the 7-day average of new cases has more than doubled in Dane County from 60 cases on March 17th to 133 on Thursday, according to Public Health Madison and Dane County. Nationally, health experts are preparing for another COVID surge. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has adopted Republican-drawn maps for the state legislature after initially approving maps drawn by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. The court reversed itself Friday after the U.S. Supreme Court in March said Evers' maps were incorrectly adopted. In WPR weather, rain and snow likely across the state today, breezy in the north and highs around 40. On Tuesday, a mix of sun and clouds in the southeast, mostly sunny for the rest of Wisconsin, highs mostly in the mid to upper 40s, but cooler near Lake Superior. It's WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from Indeed, committed to helping businesses attract, interview, and hire candidates. Businesses can invite candidates to apply, then schedule and conduct virtual interviews all in one place. Indeed.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. There was more unrest over the weekend in Jerusalem. Dozens were hurt Friday in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound when Israeli police used tear gas and stun grenades against Palestinians throwing stones. In the middle of Ramadan, police stormed the mosque, considered the third holiest site in Islam. Medical officials said 150 Palestinians and three police officers were injured. Hundreds of Palestinians were arrested. On Sunday, Israeli police were back, saying they wanted to clear a path for Jews visiting the hilltop compound, revered by Jews as the Temple Mount, the holiest site in Judaism. Police blocked Muslims from parts of the site, and more arrests were made. Palestinians accuse Israel of a dangerous escalation during a rare convergence of Passover, Ramadan, and Easter, when even larger crowds of worshippers were visiting Jerusalem. Similar violence a year ago was one of the events that contributed to the eruption of an 11-day-long war in Gaza. We've reached out to Mayrav Sunshine. She is a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, and she joins us from Tel Aviv. Good morning.
Good morning.
So if you could just break down what led to what we saw Friday and over the weekend.
Yeah, well, the situation of the convergence of Ramadan and the other holidays, the Christian holiday of Easter and the Jewish holiday of Passover, sounded alarm bells for the Israeli government, and even the Biden administration had warned that tensions rise because many, many people flood into the Old City on these days. And because of the precedent of last year where Ramadan caused, it wasn't Ramadan itself, but it was the fact that the police, the Israeli police, were in full force and using many crowd dispersal means. So there was fear that the same thing would happen this year. And in fact, it's been relatively calm compared to last year and compared to what could be the case.
So is this moment at all similar to what prompted the 11-day war last year? Could it escalate to that level?
Yeah, it really is a very fragile, intense situation, and people need to remember that East Jerusalem is occupied and annexed. The people, the Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, don't have a police force. They're not citizens of the country. They are kind of at the will of the police force. So there's always tensions every day for Palestinians who live in that area. And it's also important to remember that Damascus Gate, the Old City, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where they pray during Ramadan, are the main areas where East Jerusalem Palestinians can congregate and celebrate the holiday together. So when you have a police force that comes in, even if it's just a minority of kids who are, you know, stirring up trouble, it can very easily escalate. And so we're seeing very similar pictures to last year, but there are differences in how the Israeli government is handling the situation. It has indicated and signaled in various ways that it's actually interested in keeping the peace, and in some ways it's doing its best to do so.
A very different sentiment than what we saw last year.
Yes, also because Israel has been in dialogue with Jordan. It has also lifted a curfew on the West Bank that normally is held for the entire Jewish holiday. So there are very specific actions that the Israeli government is taking to try to signal to the Palestinians that it's not interested in engaging in a certain amount of collective punishment for the few. At the same time, we've seen images of police brutality using batons on worshippers entering the mosque, which for, you know, Palestinians is a huge infringement of their rights.
And it didn't just start this weekend, these tensions, right? I mean, there were, over the past couple of weeks, 14 people were killed in a wave of attacks in Israel. Israeli forces have stepped up raids in the Palestinian West Bank. So far, dozens of Palestinians reportedly injured. At least 25 have been killed by Israeli forces. I mean, if we could talk about the bigger picture here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in Israel-Palestine, there's kind of never a quiet moment, certainly not for Palestinians. But we've had a wave of terror attacks that we have not seen in Israel for many years, specifically shooting attacks in four different Israeli cities, something that Israelis have not seen in quite a while. So I think about 14 Israelis were killed. And as well, the IDF has stepped up its raid in the West Bank. It's entered the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank several times, and often killing people who are in exchange in gun battles. So we've had a rise in tensions in the West Bank specifically. And also there's been a few incidents of Israeli soldiers who are deployed in greater numbers now as a result, who have shot at unarmed, for example, an unarmed woman who's 47 years old. She didn't present any threat. She was shot and killed, tragically. So all these things have been happening on the backdrop of this current crisis.
Mayrav Sunshine, senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. Thank you for being on the program.
Thanks so much.
The Boston Marathon is underway with about 30,000 people participating. For the first time in 3 years, the race is happening on the traditional Patriots Day. From GBH in Boston, Esteban Bustillos has more.
There are a few days that mean more to Boston than Patriots Day, the third Monday of each April when Massachusetts commemorates the battles of Lexington and Concord. It's also the day when hundreds of thousands of spectators and runners descend upon the city and its outskirts for the annual Boston Marathon. At least it was before COVID canceled the in-person race in 2020 and pushed its running to October last year. But now, for the first time in 3 years, the marathon is back in its rightful Patriots Day time slot. And for runners in this year's race, it's a much-needed return to normalcy. Madeline Silva lives in New York City. She ran the marathon in the fall, but this will be her first Patriots Day race.
I mean, training for two marathons within 6 months was definitely a task, but I kind of felt like I couldn't pass it up. Of all the marathons I've done, this is my fourth. Definitely Boston's been my favorite experience so far.
Thomas Habimana, who made the trip from Indiana, is a veteran of the race. This will be his fifth time running the Boston Marathon, but this run will have some special meaning.
I felt this one is going to be a little bit different. It's, you know, restarting new after, I hope it's post-COVID. It's just fantastic. So it's so good that we're probably able to get our lives back.
Unfortunately, Boston isn't out of the COVID woods just yet. Cases are on the rise again. But at the marathon finish line the day before the race, there was still a cautious sense of hope the marathon brought. Father Michael Sliney is a priest based out of Washington, D.C., who is running his first Boston Marathon. Sliney, understandably, was coming off a pretty busy Holy Week as he made final preparations for the race. And while he's offering blessings to any runners who may feel like they'll need a little help from above to cross the finish line, he sees the marathon itself as its own kind of blessing after a hard couple of years.
So I think it's a way for us to kind of almost burst out of the tunnel and see the light with everybody else, and it's kind of symbolic of that. The culmination of a long road that hopefully is going to open up to a brighter sunshine.
And as the marathon and the country try to get back to normal, hopefully that forecast of clear skies stays true. For NPR News, I'm Esteban Bustillos in Boston.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later this hour. Malaysian comedian Nigel Ung blew up on YouTube at the start of the pandemic with his character Uncle Roger, who would roast Western chefs' attempts at Asian cooking. Now Ung is on his first U.S. tour trying to establish himself as a stand-up comedian outside the shadow of Uncle Roger. We'll hear more in 9 minutes.
Explore how lasers can help combat cancer and how soil can lead to the discovery of new antibiotics in PBS Wisconsin, Education's newest resource. Meet the Lab, an online collection of educational resources for middle school science classrooms. Funded in part through the Timothy William Trout Education Fund, the full collection is available for free use by teachers, educators, and families at pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of brands like Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex. More about Kimberly-Clark's 149 years of commitment to innovation at kimberly-clark.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Village of Williams Bay presents a pop-up Earth Day event at the Green Grocer and Clean Water Salon Spa, featuring live music, earth-friendly wine, and art, April 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. Search Williams Bay Earth Day on Google.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and here's some of what's happening in the news. The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea says Washington and Seoul have agreed on the need for a strong response to Pyongyang's recent spate of missile tests, though they remain open to dialogue with the country. Sung Kim flew to South Korea today for talks, 2 days after North Korea conducted a new type of missile test in its 13th round of weapons firings this year. Today is tax day, the federal deadline for individual tax filings and payments. The IRS is expected to receive tens of millions of last-minute filings electronically and through paper forms. The executive director of the National Society of Tax Professionals, Nina Trost, says if people haven't filed their taxes by now, they're better off filing an extension. Stay with us. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio just after 9, and then classical music for your Monday with Stephanie Elkins.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from C3AI. C3AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3AI is enterprise AI.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. School systems across the country are grappling with teacher shortages. One of the most pressing problems in many places involves a lack of substitute teachers. In Illinois, school districts held one-day training sessions to try to recruit substitutes and move them into the classroom as soon as possible. From member station WNIJ in DeKalb, Peter Medlin reports.
Some schools are so desperate for substitutes, they've tried recruiting parents. Others have asked local police officers and firefighters to come into the classroom. In New Mexico, they've even called in the National Guard. In Illinois, a short-term substitute license was created in direct response to the shortage. It allows potential teachers who only have an associate degree or 60 hours of college credit to become substitutes in public schools. Mark Kleisner heads the group West 40, a service center for dozens of school districts near Chicago. He says the short-term option is a lifeline because the shortage in this state is worse than ever.
I'm hearing social workers covering English classes. You know, it's like we're not serving our kids well, and we don't really have a choice. Our data point this year was over 2,000 educator openings were either unfilled or they were filled by someone not qualified.
Sonia Spalding is a professional learning specialist at West 40. She's trying to address the shortage by offering prospective substitutes an online crash course in teaching before they step into the classroom.
We are here to provide you the state-approved short-term substitute training. I'm sort of the captain of today's ship, and I've got a wonderful crew that's going to help you get in the air and land to your prospective locations. We've got
this recent Zoom call is filling up with dozens of faces as Spalding gets started. Some people watch on their phones while walking down hallways at work. Many have experience working with kids. Others just need work. Depending on the school, the pay can range from $100 to over $200 a day. With the program, substitutes pay $50 to get their license, take the training, get a background check, and can be in the classroom the very next day.
It's a quick turnaround, but there's a high level of confidence that these are people who have a connection with the community, and they really want to step up and support the students in this time.
Nicole Mister is one of the hundreds of new short-term substitutes they've already trained this year. Like most, she's interested in teaching because of her connection to education. She has kids in school and works at an education nonprofit. She says while her first day subbing was difficult, the one-day training actually did help her in the classroom.
It was nerve-wracking, but Dr. Spalding was able to really give us some great pointers. She really just told us to, you know, go in with an open mind, and she gave us so many resources online, so it was really able to help.
But some worry about lowering the barrier to get into the classroom. Desiree Carver-Thomas is a researcher and policy analyst at the Learning Policy Institute.
It's certainly a huge concern, especially when you hear stories of students who've had, you know, a rotating cast of substitute teachers all year in their math class. It begs the question of, you know, how much learning can really happen when the person in the classroom, you know, may not have subject matter competency.
But she says in many states, substitutes aren't required to do any training at all. So anything is a positive. And when so many schools can't find any subs, it's better than canceling classes. But she and others say the long-term solution to the substitute teacher shortage isn't only about substitutes. It's about hiring enough credentialed teachers to fully staff classrooms. For NPR News, I'm Peter Medlin.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for tuning in for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news for you coming up in 10 minutes, and then classical music for your Monday morning.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
Yes, Paco Frelick blends notes of country, folk, pop, and Native Americana. Join us at 7:30 on June 9th at Whitewater Music Hall in Wausau. Details at WPR.org/presents.
In sports, the defending champion Milwaukee Bucks recovered after blowing a 16-point lead to beat the Chicago Bulls 93-86 in Game 1 of their first-round playoff series Sunday. Game 2 is Wednesday night. The Brewers beat St. Louis 6-5 yesterday to split the four-game series. They'll start a series against the Pirates this evening. And in the weather forecast, rain and snow likely across the state, breezy in the north, and highs around 40 today.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Egg fried rice is considered simple to make. The ingredients are in the name. You want some day-old rice. You want some eggs. You need a wok to cook with. If you're a celebrity chef like, say, Jamie Oliver, you better get those little details right, though, because Uncle Roger may come after you, as in this YouTube clip.
Egg fried rice. It's an absolute classic. And I've got a...
2 seconds into video, and I already see saucepan hiya. Where your wok, Jamie? Where your wok?
Egg fried rice. Uncle Roger character is a YouTube star with millions of followers, and he was created by a Malaysian comic, Nigel Ung, who's on the North American leg of a world tour. NPR's Andrew Limbong caught up with him.
Nigel Ung has been grinding it out as a stand-up for over a decade now.
Clubs, back room of bars, open mics, everywhere.
He quit his day job and committed to doing stand-up full-time in late 2019. Then the pandemic hit, and he's at home in London hosting a podcast called Rice to Meet You with his comedian friend Evelyn Mok. One day, they're riffing, bouncing ideas off of each other.
I started doing an Asian accent. And then with the accent, I threw in some attitude there as well to kind of mimic my older generation Asian uncles.
The kind of uncle that's always talking trash and smoking cigarettes and maybe still owes your mom some money. But a lovable uncle who refers to everyone as niece or nephew. The name Roger is a nod to the type of anglicized name that's a byproduct of colonization in Malaysia. Kind of like Nigel, actually. And as for his look...
I DM all my friends, they send me a picture of your dad.
So now, Uncle Roger always wears an orange polo, tucked in, huge phone case attached to his belt. As for the content, he tried a couple different things, but what really popped off was this.
Hello, my name is Uncle Roger. Today, I will react to a video sent to me by a fan.
It's a BBC video of presenter Harsha Patel making egg fried rice, which, let's say, deviated from the norms of how an Eastern Asian person might make egg fried rice.
Like, he was hilariously bad.
For every one part rice you have, you need two parts water. It's as simple as that.
Who? Why you measure water with cup? Just use finger. First join the finger. That's how you measure the water, not with British teacup. Hiya. First.
And it just blew up from there.
The video currently has 29 million views on YouTube.
Looking back now, I realize I've combined three things that, you know, not many people have combined those things in, you know, the YouTube idiom, the reaction video, the character comedy, and then a relatable thing like food.
Ung took that formula and ran with it, reacting to other Western chefs botching Asian cooking. Folks like Gordon Ramsay, Rachel Ray, Nigella Lawson, and he'll hammer on repeated themes that Western chefs constantly get wrong about Asian cooking. Here's Jenny Lau. She runs Celestial Peach, which is a platform dedicated to telling the story of Chinese food.
I think one of the things that he's sort of obviously taken on is this demystification of MSG.
Which actually isn't that bad for you and is found naturally in all sorts of foods like tomatoes and cheeses.
Where your MSG? You don't use MSG. How to make good egg fried rice? This is just white people egg fried rice. MSG.
Although a lot of, you know, other sort of food voices have tried to educate on this, I think the fact that Nigel does it in a really funny way, that's quite a smart way to do it.
And Uncle Roger gets to both educate and complain about cultural appropriation without coming off as what Lau referred to as a boba liberal. But now we gotta talk about the accent. The common critiques thrown at Ung about it is that it's stereotypical. It makes Asians look bad. The celebrated chef, cookbook author, and fellow food YouTuber J. Kenji Lopez-Alt wrote in the description of his own egg fried rice video that, quote, "It's ugly, it's yellow face, it's not funny, and it promotes anti-Asian racism at a time when Asians are already being heavily discriminated against." Lopez-Alt declined to talk to me, but even Jenny Lau expressed some initial discomfort with the shtick, as did Brian Tsao, a chef at Mission Sandwich Social in Brooklyn, which opens later this year.
Because I was like, you know, should I be supporting this? Is this pushing forward, you know, a stereotype that I don't really want out there for the rest of the world to judge us based on?
Tsao's also got his own YouTube React channel about food and cooking. And for him, a light sort of switched when he realized that these Western chefs Uncle Roger was reacting to were giving Asian cooking a bad reputation.
And Uncle Roger calls out the in the exact accent that is meant to demean us. So in many ways, like, I feel like it's empowering.
For Ung, this debate crystallizes the difference between being Asian American or East Asian in the UK and just being Asian.
We grew up very differently, right? I grew up in Malaysia. And when a friend puts on that accent, it means they are being friendly. They're trying to be funny. And it, for a lot of Malaysians, when you hear that, and people come up to me after the show saying that when I hear the accent, it reminds me of home. And to me, that it reminds me of home too, because that's how we talk to each other when we let our guards down.
Of course, folks in the Asian diaspora have their guards up for a reason.
I got punched, man, in London. This is real.
I caught Ung recently at one of his 4 sold-out shows at the Gramercy Theater in Manhattan. The crowd was mostly Asian, but not all, and he did a few minutes of material based on being attacked right as Uncle Roger was getting famous.
I was walking on my street, I was almost home, right? This guy was on a bicycle, he saw me, he jumped off his bike and just walked towards me really aggressively. And at first I thought he wanted a photo. I said, hey, he's a nephew.
He came out relatively unscathed.
The worst thing about getting punched is when the police show up at your house, they don't take their shoes off.
Ung is in an interesting place as a comedian. Both because of the pandemic and the rise of Uncle Roger, his first ever tour as a headliner is this huge one he's in the middle of right now. And he wants people to walk away thinking about Nigel as a stand-up. But he still has to put on that orange polo and open his show as Uncle Roger. Because that's what people want to see, like an orange polo albatross around his neck. I asked him if he's thinking about retiring the Uncle Roger character, at least live.
It would be nice. It means I would work less. You know, I don't have to carry extra orange polos around. Although I kind of want to get a t-shirt gun to my next show, the t-shirt cannon, to launch orange polos into the crowd.
Because he's here to sell tickets. And he said at the end of the day, Uncle Roger and nephew Nigel share the same bank account. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Thanks for tuning in for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear it weekdays from 5 to 9 a.m. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour. plus more news on our website at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/WPR.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who would like to have newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or call 564-3744.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.